How does my prayer intersect with God's cosmic concern? Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Mathilde Frey. I am professor of Old Testament at Walla Walla University. And I'm here today together with Jody Washburn and Dave Thomas. Together we study Daniel chapter 10. Earthly crisis, but it is worked out on a cosmic stage. Chapter 10 takes us into a different world that goes even beyond the creatures and the beasts that we have seen in the previous visions of Daniel. Before we go to those, I would just like to shortly mention the last part of chapter 9, where we spoke about Gabriel, who explains the vision or the appearance of that human-like being to Daniel after he prayed. Gabriel in the book of Daniel appears only two times. He's mentioned specifically only two times. First in chapter 8 and then in chapter 9. In these chapters, in both, he refers to that human-like being that Daniel sees in chapter 8. And then in chapter 9, he tells Daniel who that is, namely the Messiah, the prince who is going to give his life and restore the city and the temple and the people.
So that's how the shame will disappear then?
In that sense, yeah. He will take it away.
Okay.
Now note that the New Testament makes a very interesting parallelism to that. Gabriel appears in the New Testament in the Gospels also only two times. He appears to Zacharias, the priest, who will have a son who will be the forerunner of Christ, John the Baptist. And then he appears to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and announces the birth of Christ.
Who will be called
Emmanuel.
But also he will save his people from their sins.
Yes.
So you see what the New Testament gospel writers have done in parallelism to reading the book of Daniel before. They have set it up in such a way that this angelic being, Gabriel, comes only, he has a specific purpose, to announce the Messiah.
Wow.
So now to chapter 10, where Daniel is in a remarkable vision. We are in the third year of Cyrus the king. Many people already have returned to Babylon by this time. And Daniel
you mean
has...
to Jerusalem.
To Jerusalem. And Daniel is in the middle of all of this. Now, he is also an older man at this point and probably moved out of Babylon to Susa on the other side of the banks of the Tigris River, where he probably lived his last days of life. So in this part, he has the vision, and that appearance of the man comes back to him. And chapter 10 is all about how does he look in chapter 10? How is he dressed? That gives us clues and hints who it really is. It just extends the explanation of Gabriel in chapter 9 to tell us more about who this being is.
Is this similar to the one in Revelation?
Yes. Where he's dressed in a linen...
Yeah, and he's walking between the candlesticks.
Right.
Yeah.
He has a golden sash or a belt.
Yeah.
And in Daniel's vision, he is gleaming. Fire, like a precious stones.
So he sees this is not a human. It's not an ordinary human.
Yes. So he's clearly the linen aspect and the belt are parts of the priestly garment.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a high priest in this part in the book of Daniel. But Daniel is unable to stand before him and to face him. So at least two times, I believe, he falls down as if he is almost dead. Yes, no
pale.
Breath.
He turns pale.
It's interesting that the people with him ran away, even though they didn't see the vision.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, he's lifted up and touched.
He's touched. He's touched, I believe, at least two times here in this case. And to me, that is an important part here, how the divine high priest deals with frail human creatures.
Mm.
Isn't that a connection to the book of Hebrews, where it sets up and tells us we do have a high priest.
Who knows.
Yes.
Yes.
But also the shepherd who went searching for his sheep, who cares for his sheep.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that, O Daniel, man greatly loved. Yes. So he's reassured.
Again, a parallel to Luke 1,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
With where Gabriel is talking and saying, highly favored.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, when all of this happened, he came out of a 3 weeks fast.
Mm-hmm. Which is long.
Yeah.
Too long.
That must have made him depleted.
I think so.
Right?
Yeah. And isn't it longer than other places in Scripture where they describe a fast, right? It's usually for
3 weeks, a very long time. You
for
could be
a
dead.
Few days or 1 week. And, and here you have 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So multitude
and again, and Jacques Toucan, that you have mentioned a few times before, points out that this is not a real usual time that you usually fast in Jewish tradition.
So it makes it extra shocking that he would have a long fast when he should be feasting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's testament to his distress, probably.
Yes. Mm. He decides to fast in a time of the year when you should not. You should celebrate the Passover festival. And for that, you would have to eat meat, the lamb, and have
wine.
Your 4 cups of wine in the ritual, traditional way. And he goes against all of that and fasts for 3 weeks during the entire time when the Passover and the following weeks are celebrated, usually.
And so this has to mean something. I mean, obviously he's contrasting, he's appalled, or he's turned pale, lost his strength, all of this. But like, is this hearkening back to the original context of the Passover? The idea of deliverance from Egypt? Like, what are the connections that are trying, you know, that the text is trying to make us make as we read and notice these parallels?
Well, If the first group of people have gone back already to Jerusalem to build it and have started to build a temple, but then face all those
opposition
that we have in Ezra and Nehemiah from the people living there. And Daniel is here and is concerned. He knows there is to be this Messiah. He has received the answer of his prayer.
Yeah.
But there is this opposition against his own people, and he is in a turbulent mindset.
Do you think that's why he experiences so much exhaustion and terror? Is it the juxtaposition of the sort of what we've called good news of judgment or of this divine being coming in the visions juxtaposed against his knowledge of the reality? Do you think that's where part of the terror comes?
I do think that there is, think back of the story of the Israelites in Egypt, in those times of the 10 plagues. Is it possible that we have something like that happening when those Palestinian people oppose the ones who have gone back to rebuild, and in Babylon there are still a lot more who maybe are getting ready to leave, because they don't leave all at once. They leave in waves. That's what we know historically, also.
Mm-hmm.
So, is Daniel here dealing with this situation to try to get his people that are young enough to go back home and rebuild, to get them going?
Huh.
Just go. But
don't start from nothing.
Yes. So he encounters this high priestly man who comes as a high priest to assure him, do not be afraid.
Yeah.
Right?
But isn't there something of a cosmic struggle in here too, though?
Yeah.
So what do you make of that?
Yeah.
I mean, here...
I needed to help. Michael needed always the help of those others because he had to fight against the Prince of Persia and then the Prince of Greece and so on.
And it shows what we could call heavenly concern too. Mm-hmm. Like Daniel's concern is a reflection of the fact that God is concerned about the plight of the returned exiles and about the desperate need for this true Messiah, right? For these good things to happen.
But you know what concerns me about this is that here something is actually making the accomplishment of the Messiah's purposes is resisting it almost successfully.
Yes.
And see, so are these cosmic powers or these human powers that the squabble between good and evil here, or the Messiah and those who contend against him, it seems to be pretty tough that he is delayed, he's prevented from fulfilling his purposes. Not ultimately, but in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's part of the significant tension I think we have. Hindsight is 20/20, right? We look back on all of this in the entire overarching biblical narrative, and we see Daniel in chapter 9 praying desperately for probably this Messiah to bring the people back and establish them successfully in the land again. And yet, what is the answer to that prayer? It's this messianic prophecy that then we stretch out over all these many, 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 many years,
mm-hmm.
right? That yes, hope is coming. This is not the end of the story, but what you thought was going to be the answer is not a full answer. There's more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then chapter 10 does not give him a real answer.
No, it doesn't.
Just further explanation further picturing.
Yeah. So it is basically a back and forth what he sees, what he hears, and how that high priest is like approaching him, touching and reassuring, comforting, and so on. So the entire chapter is how does God take care
mm-hmm.
of this elderly man
mm-hmm.
who is so disturbed about all the situation that is happening to
and
his
jumping
people.
Ahead, he never does get an answer, does he?
Nope.
But he just gets reassurance. Yeah.
Reassurance.
Times.
Yes.
Yeah. And we should add before moving on too quickly that, right, isn't 10, 11, 12 a unit?
Yes.
Right? So we're no longer looking at individual units, but what we've read here is mm-hmm. is an introduction or a framing of this larger unit. And you see echoes of the words like, you know, stand up, the understanding. There are frames, right, that we see again in chapter 12. And mm-hmm. you get the sense of how this is working together.
Yes. It comes out of chapter 9, but it becomes the full unit from chapter 1 to the end of the book. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Thank you so much, Jody and Dave, for this week's lesson, and Abby Wissing, for our engineer, and to all our listeners for Good Word. I'm Matilda Fry.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.